This is Stateside. I'm Erin Allen, in for April Bear. Today is part two of two in our conversations about Black people passing as white. This time, we'll hear a story of someone who passed from our neck of the woods.
Elsie grows up in this sort of incubator of aspiring and social climbing, if you will, African-Americans in Detroit, and ultimately changes her name, and her brownish black hair becomes Lucille Ball Auburn. Elsie Roxborough is adapting to the times that suggest to her in order to be what she ultimately wants to be, that is advantageous for her because of her light skin, to pass.
In 1914, Elsie Roxborough was born into a wealthy black family in Detroit. But when she died in 1949, her death certificate listed her as white. Coming of age in an era of black artistic expression and popularity, Elsie pursued a successful life as a writer. Her childhood in Detroit's early black middle class was well-heeled for the time, but the societal benefits of living as a white person drew her to a new life in New York City. Her life was rich, curious, and at times troubled, all while attempting a sort of high wire act of living multiple lives between multiple names and cities and races. Here to give us a sense of the context in which Elsie grew up and eventually decided to pass is writer and reporter Ken Coleman, who's been writing about the Roxborough family for several years now.
You know, passing, it certainly was something that we saw throughout America when given the opportunity. There were some African-Americans who sought to have a piece of the American dream. And because of racism carried out by mores largely in the South, but to some extent in the North, like Jim Crow, that divided people solely by the basis of race, not by their character, not by their deeds, but just the way they looked, it became advantageous for people to, if they could, African-Americans, if they could, if they their skin was light enough, to what we, you know, the term was pass. This is what America looked like for African-Americans. And if you were someone whose skin was as light as Elsie's, it provided opportunities for you. And there were African-Americans who took advantage of that.
Okay, so what about the Roxborough family? Tell me, who were they? How did they live?
Absolutely. The Roxboroughs were one of Detroit's leading families in the early part of the 1900s. They arrived in Detroit in 1898 or 1899. The original Charles Roxborough had lived in Cleveland and in New Orleans, like a lot of families, moved north, further north. They arrive in Detroit ahead of what we know as the Great Migration, where Blacks from the South were coming to the North seeking greater opportunities and employment and housing and the like. The Roxboroughs arrive here, and because Charles Roxborough is a lawyer, they become one of the leading families. The original Charles Roxborough would have been Elsie Roxborough's grandfather. Elsie was born in 1914, but the family sets up roots in Detroit, and through their work, their deeds in the city, become a leading family.
Okay. Who was Elsie? What would her childhood have been like in the Roxborough household? What was her life like, would you say?
Yes, Elsie Roxborough is born in 1914, and if we can place her birth date along with the timeline of what was going on in Detroit and Michigan and the rest of the country, it really is the start of Detroit becoming a leading city in America. It is the same year that the auto baron Henry Ford perfects the assembly line, and his auto plants in the Detroit area become sort of the leading economic force in creating goods and services. And so Elsie's birth coincides with Ford debuting the assembly line that allows tens of thousands of people to be employed, tens of thousands of vehicles to be manufactured in a small period of time. It also drives a lot of African Americans to urban centers like Detroit and Chicago and New York and Philadelphia. Ultimately, what happens in the 19-teens and 20s is tens of thousands of African Americans move to the city looking for that American dream.
Okay, so this is a time when the Great Migration has happened. Lots of Black folks living in Detroit everywhere. And eventually, Elsie goes to the University of Michigan. How would her life have been different in Detroit compared to going to U of M, as far as the racial dynamics? Do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, certainly growing up in Detroit in the 1920s and early 1930s before she goes to the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, 45 minutes away, and in some cases, a world away, because Detroit, while it was a growing city at the time in the 20s and 30s, and more African-Americans were moving there. And certainly in the space where she lived much of her young life, a section of Detroit called the North End, it was a very growing section of middle-class African-Americans. And so Elsie grows up in this sort of incubator of aspiring and social climbing, if you will, African-Americans in Detroit. And then she goes to the University of Michigan that's, frankly, lily white. She graduates within 4 years. She is generally considered to be one of the first African-American scholars at the University of Michigan to live in a dormitory. And there are very few African-Americans around for support. And that must have been a world of difference from the space where she had grown up to where she was as a 18 and 19 and 20-year-old.
It was at U of M where Elsie became interested in becoming a writer, right? And she ended up writing several plays. They're produced in Chicago and Detroit under her own name. And she was writing at the same time as other Black literary legends of the Harlem Renaissance, like Langston Hughes, Nella Larson, Zora Neale Hurston. What would you say it was like for Black creatives trying to make it back then in the 30s and 40s?
It was certainly a challenge for men and women who happened to be African American, who wanted to be playwrights, wanted to publish poetry, wanted to write prose, you know, write literary documents, be reporters. It was a challenging time for them, just like it was a challenging time for African Americans to do a lot of different, have a lot of different careers as a vocation. But one of the things that was inspiring to Elsie Roxburgh, you know, even some 600 or 700 miles west, growing up in Detroit, Michigan, is what happened in the Harlem Renaissance in the 1920s and 30s. And so she, because of the family stature in Detroit, had access to be able to meet people like Langston Hughes. While it was rumored that they were a romantic item, we've learned in recent decades that wasn't necessarily so. But Hughes was very much thought that Elsie Roxburgh very much was an up-and-coming and talented young writer and to some degree mentored her. And that's what Elsie had because of her family stature. Even going to a place that was sort of lonely for her at the University of Michigan, she still had connections with the Black intelligentsia, both in Detroit and spaces like New York City, where the Harlem Renaissance was in full effect in the 1920s and into the 30s.
Time to take a quick break. See you in a minute.
Support for the Stateside Podcast comes from the University of Michigan's Go Blue Guarantee, committed to keeping a U of M undergraduate education within reach of all Michigan residents, regardless of socioeconomic status. Programs are available for all three campuses. More at goblueguarantee.umich.edu.
Support for Michigan Public's Stateside podcast comes from Lake Trust Credit Union, working to empower financial well-being for Michigan consumers, businesses, and communities. Committed to financial solutions and advice to support people and families. More information at laketrust.org.
So eventually, Elsie moves to New York. When did that happen? Why did she move?
We believe it happens in 1937. She graduates from the University of Michigan, ultimately moves to New York City because she wants to be a playwright. And that is the center, the epicenter where playwrights write and direct and houses and spaces, theaters are there to be spaces in which their work can be shown to the masses. And so while Detroit was building cars and an industrial center for the country, Elsie realizes that if you really want to make it big and what you want to do, being a playwright, New York City is the place to go. And so she almost immediately goes to New York City after graduation from the University of Michigan. There's some reporting that suggests that she is there by 1937 and ultimately changes her name. She ceases from being Elsie Roxborough, at least professionally, changed her name to Pat Rico at one point, and then ultimately Mona Manet. And her brownish black hair becomes Lucille Ball Auburn.
Her brownish black hair changes. She changes her name. She's changing.
She's adapting. Elsie Roxborough is adapting to the times that suggest to her in order to be what she ultimately wants to be, a great playwright that is advantageous for her because of her light skin to pass, to cease from being a Negro or being colored to being white. And there's lots of research and reporting that suggests during her time in New York City between 1937 and the time that she dies in 1949, that she, in effect, lived as a white person, had a white roommate, which meant that she had no desire to have an outwardly connection with the family that she left behind in Detroit and many of the friends that she had, you know, had grown up with. Because she wanted to become a professional playwright. And society suggested to her that the way to do it was to move to New York and live as a white person.
What was her life like in New York, you know, in those years between her moving and her passing away?
She had, she certainly moves to New York City. So if she wants to live in the community now known as Greenwich Village, she works and strives. She did come back to Detroit on occasion, sometimes leading and directing theatrical performances at the Detroit Art Institute and other spaces, sometimes Black churches. But she certainly works on her craft for the little bit more of a decade that she lives after arriving in New York City.
You mentioned that she became more and more estranged from her family. I mean, how did this impact them? Do we know, you know, what their relationship was like?
Yes, great question. What we know about the Roxborough family was they attained a great deal of status in Detroit and to some extent the African-American community throughout the nation. But they were a family that was challenged. And what I mean by that is there are members of the family who had estranged relationships, like a lot of families do. Elsie Roxborough's father was a well-known statewide politician in Michigan. Her uncle, John Roxborough, manages Joe Lewis. So he's, you know, on the road a lot, ultimately goes to prison, state prison, Jackson State Prison, because he's convicted of operating and masterminding a multi-million dollar numbers business. So John Roxborough goes to jail for a couple of years in the early 1940s. Her father, what we know about Charles Roxborough, her father, was someone who was very aloof. There's lots of reporting that suggests that he was a heavy drinker that caused a lot of problems in the family. And so Elsie had a lot of those challenges facing her in terms of her family life, which some suggest that made it an easier move for her to go to New York City. But she did come back to Detroit on occasion. There is writing through interviews done with people that she grew up with that suggests that she was certainly a high-achieving, to some extent, high-strung personality, but did not totally disown Detroit in her family and did come back from time to time. I was reading just the other day, Elsie, quote, was dying to get away. And he writes dying, D-Y-E-I-N-G, sort of a play on words. that suggests that Elsie certainly wanted to leave Detroit, certainly consciously moved to New York City, consciously changed her name ultimately to Mona Manet, ultimately and strategically dyed her hair auburn red because she wanted to some extent divorce herself from the city of Detroit to become what she wanted to be, a playwright, something that she did not see as being attainable, being a Detroit resident.
Mm-hmm. So ultimately, she passed away. She died by overdosing on sleeping pills in her New York apartment. She was found by her, as you mentioned, her white roommate who was living with her at the time, and her sister went to pick her up. And given that she was a part of such a prominent family in Detroit, talk about the story around her passing. What happened there?
Yes. Yeah, so at the time the family learned of her death, you know, what has to happen, obviously, at that point is a delegation of family members go to New York City to do the work that's, you know, that has to be done when somebody passes. What didn't happen, quite frankly, is a very public memorial for Elsie. There was certainly reporting on her death back in Detroit. The Michigan Chronicle, at that point, the leading African-American newspaper, writes about her passing. But certainly what did not happen was the homegoing service that you would normally see for someone who had attained Elsie Roxborough stature, or certainly who was a member of a family that had a great African-American stature in Detroit. None of that happened. And again, I think part of it was because the Roxborough family, while they had a great deal of stature in the Black community and in Detroit, was very much a fractured group. For decades, we didn't know a whole lot about Elsie Roxborough. It really, as I've written, is really a shortcoming in our collective effort as a community, meaning African Americans, to chronicle the history of Black folk in Detroit. Mm-hmm.
What would you say as you, you know, reflect on the lives of the Roxboroughs, specifically Elsie even, what impact would you hope it would leave on Black folks in Detroit or at large?
It is a tremendous story of men and women who happen to be African-American, who strived and did incredible things against incredible odds. And that needs to be recorded better than it has over the decades. I have found their story to be a great American story, just like we talk about the Kennedys of Massachusetts or other great families in the American mosaic.
And that is the Stateside Podcast. You can find the full Stateside show at michiganradio.org. I produced this and yesterday's episodes. Other producers on our show are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, and April Van Buren. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Our theme music is by 14KT. Additional music from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Erin Allen. Thank you so much for listening.